This is 4:55 on Wednesday, September 21st. Okay, good morning. Good turnout this morning. It's not Monday and it's not Friday, I guess. Reviewing the calendar. So, 9 days from now is the first exam. On Wednesday we'll do an exam review, and the chapter 3 problems are due that day, and hopefully I'll be able in real time to sort of look through the problems and discuss them, discuss answers with you as we do the exam review. And the project is due Friday, and I realized I probably haven't put up the turn-in page for it. Anybody looked for it yet? No, I don't think I have. So I will go back to the office after class and try to remember to do that. Yeah.
We have 5 days for like total 8 days, right?
Yeah.
Five. I might be cashing it tomorrow.
It's okay. That's what they're for. So yeah. So I will put that up, and if you get to the point tomorrow and it's not there, email me. But I'll try to remember. Okay. I-916. Why is the audio not up for that? That's weird. All right. Well, we'll check that out too. Okay. So we're just going to use the system for attendance today. We're not going to do any questions. So if you want to use them for other things, preferably having something to do with class, that would be good. View. All right. Questions about the assignment before we go on. I've been talking with some of you about some issues, but I don't think they're general issues, so I won't bring them up if you don't. I hope there's progress happening on them and they're not being left to the last, very last minute. But okay. So today we're going to talk about how do we turn the unreliable datagram delivery service that is provided by the IP layer into a reliable data transfer mechanism that can be used by applications as if the internet actually provided reliable streams. And to do that, we will start with some pictures that are trying to show us what we're trying to do. So here's what we want from the perspective of the applications. We want a channel that will reliably deliver data to the receiver. And the problem is that what we really have is an unreliable channel down underneath. And the question is, what do we have to stick in the middle in order to have what appears to be a reliable channel built over this unreliable channel? So the way that they've structured this in this book is in terms of a couple of primitives that need to be implemented in this implementation. Reliable data transfer send, which does whatever it does, and then does an unreliable data transfer send, and then it's called reliable data transfer receive because it's actually an up call into this RDT layer, and then this makes an up call into the actual sockets layer of the OS. So that's what RDT and UDT stand for in these pictures. Here it's delivered. It's described in more detail. Just terminology. Why? I don't get it. Let's only have single direction arrows in this picture. So, this terminology of upcall is one that you might want to get familiar with. Have you heard about that in your operating system class by any chance? Okay. It's the idea. You usually think of, in doing top-down design, right, of programs, you've talked about that at some point. You think about the upper layers making calls into the lower layers, which return values to the upper layers. Once we get into the sort of many things happening at once with arbitrary time delays in between events, a common structuring paradigm for decomposed systems says, well, we'll still have this down call idea where we call down to the more detailed layers and they return values to us, but in some scenario or in some situations where data arrives to the lower layer, the appropriate way to deliver it to the upper layer is by making it what's called an up call from the lower layer into the upper layer. And the data is delivered along with that up call. Okay? So that's where this terminology up call comes from. And it corresponds to the upward pointing arrows. Yes, Michael?
Is it more like the upper layer is waiting for an event to happen, or is it...
Yeah, it's the upper layer is usually expecting the up call, and using techniques like threads and processes, you can do sort of, or you can turn those up calls into down calls that are just waiting to return, but in a lot of cases that threads and processes are too heavyweight. They involve too much state, and really all you need here is a little bit of local state that is referenced when the up call occurs. So that's that bit of terminology. Okay, so the way this discussion goes in this presentation is that we sort of start off trying to do a design, and we see where it breaks, and then we refine the design, and we keep doing that until we end up with a full-blown implementation, a reliable data transfer implementation. So just as background for that, we are going to make the presentation in terms of state machines, finite state machines, that operate on the sender and the receiver side independently and are triggered by messages going back and forth. And the description is we label the states with something that sometimes just says state 1 or state 2 and other times says something about what that state means. And we label the transitions with two things, an identification of the event that causes that transition to error, and a label that describes what sort of additional state manipulations or message sending that this state machine will do. Now, I think you've all seen something like this, right? State machines and labeled transitions and actions that go with them. What class is that in now?
317.
Okay. And a bit in 260. Okay. Because often the 317 picture of them leaves out the actions taken part, whereas the actual usefulness of the things, which comes up more in 260, often includes the extra.
One of the software engineering classes at 422.
422 may well talk about them as well. Good. All right. So anyway, this is familiar notation. So to begin with, we sort of back off and say, well, how would we do reliable data transfer over over a reliable channel? What would the finite state machines look like for that? And on the sender side, you have a finite state machine that's just sitting there doing nothing. Remember the picture, the layered picture, which says that something above is going to interact with this RDT layer. So it's going to make a call into the into here, which is the triggering event. It's a call to RDT send, and so the actions taken then are to make a packet out of that data and using the UDT layer, which we're for the moment assuming is actually reliable, we send the packet. All right, so that's what happens on the sender side, assuming the lower layer is reliable. On the receiver side, we're waiting for a call from below. So remember, UDT send is going to deliver the data to the UDT layer on the other side, which is then going to make an up call into the RDT layer, which is the RDT receive operation. We extract the data and ourselves make an up call to whatever it is that delivers it to the application. So is this picture okay? Are we okay with this? It's just to sort of set the stage. So this reliable data transfer is a hard problem in networking. It is something that people worked on probably for 20 years before it got done right. And so the easier way to approach it is to sort of consider different kinds of underlying channels and address the problems that they raise in stages. So we'll start with a channel that just has errors, just has bit errors, which means that it may change the contents of a packet, but it doesn't ever drop or reorder packets. Okay. So that's our first take on it. We will use a checksum of some sort to detect those bit errors, and we will sort of respond to packets with checksum errors by sort of not delivering them to the client application, but rather doing something else in the protocol in order to make the sender send them again. Right? So that's the scheme. Terminology: little packets that we send that just say "I got it" are called ACKs, acknowledgments, and little packets that we send that tell the receiver we didn't get it, we're not happy with what we got, are called NACs, or negative acknowledgments. And the idea of this protocol is that we'll design the states of machines so that the sender will get a NAC when a packet has been damaged, and that will cause it to send it again. How's it working? The receiver is actually the more interesting thing. It will drive the picture here. So the receiver is waiting for the call from below, just like before, and the thing that gets delivered to it is either corrupt or not corrupt. In the case that it is not corrupt, we do what we did before. We just deliver it up to the up to the application. But if it's corrupt, we send back a NAC for that packet, and then we look at what happens over here. Oh, and we also send an ACK to the receiver, to the sender in the not corrupt case. In the sender, we're sometimes waiting for the call from above that's going to send new data, and other times we're waiting for the ACK or the NAC. So we now have two states in the sender, and depending on whether we get a NAC or an ACK, we either resend the packet or we go back to waiting for the next packet. Okay? So that's simple enough protocol. But what's the realisticness? What's the word?
Reality of the situation?
Realism?
Realism? Realism of this kind of underlying channel. Probably not very good, actually. If a channel can flip bits, it may well just not deliver things. So, all right. Well, we talked through that. We didn't need all these fancy errors to do that. Okay. So, yes.
Wait. How is it possible for it to just flip bits?
Cosmic rays. Cosmic rays.
Defects in the cable.
Radio interference.
Okay.
Lots of things can, you know, electrical noise in the electronics. Squirrels may or may not flip bits. I don't know.
They can attack the cable.
They can attack the cable, which
or
may
your computer.
Or your computer. Okay. So the flaw is what happens if the ACK or the NAC is corrupted in this. Go back and look. What if we got back here, right? We assumed that the corruption could occur in the forward direction. What happens if we get back here a packet that's corrupt in this story? See the problem? Let's assume that we can tell that it's corrupt, at least, you know, that it's not, that we don't accept a lie. But what are we supposed to do in that case? It doesn't tell us in this picture. And it turns out that you can try both things, right? You can say, well, suppose I get a corrupt packet. I'll just always, in that case, treat it as a NAC. What's the result then? Well, delivering two duplicate packets, actually. We would deliver the data twice to the applicant.
Think that it's the next packet that it should be receiving.
That's why when I say deliver, I mean deliver it to the receiving application. So yes, if we always treat it as a NAC, we'll sometimes send duplicate data. If we always treat it as an ACK, sometimes the receiver will actually not have delivered the data, and so it's, you know, there's no choice we can make with this protocol that works. So it gets more complicated. So to do this, we actually take the first step down the path toward sequence numbers. And in this protocol, we're just going to have a one-bit sequence number. So we're going to flip back and forth between packets labeled 0 and packets labeled 1. And so what will happen is, you know, on the sender side, we will wait for a good ACK or NACK. To arrive, and once we get a good ACK, we'll move to the state of sending the packet with the next sequence number. Right. So, and if we get a corrupt ACK or NACK packet, we'll resend. All right. So now the difference is that on the receiving side, we know which one we're waiting for. Are we waiting for 0 or are we waiting for 1? And if we get a duplicate for one we've already delivered, we can just throw it away because it's not what we're waiting for anymore. All right? So you can look at that one. So we doubled the number of states in the sender, and we also doubled the number of states in the receiver, because now sometimes we're waiting for a 0 packet and sometimes we're waiting for a 1 packet. Question?
Oh.
No. Yeah. Okay. All right.
And then the receiver would send back an ACK for sequence whatever.
Right. So if you look here, when it's sending back the ACK, I guess it doesn't say, it doesn't have to say which one it is in this scheme. It just knows what it's waiting for.
Yeah,
right.
And it couldn't send back an ACK for something it didn't receive.
It didn't like, so it would send a NACK, and yeah. Okay. All right. Well, this is a slightly more realistic example. The channel is at least assumed to be able to corrupt packets in both directions, but we're still assuming that the sender and receiver will get something every time a packet is sent. Must get something, yes. Okay. Anything interesting there? Notice that the receiver never knows whether the last ACK or NACK that it sent was received okay. It just, but it doesn't matter. It doesn't have to. Now, we can tweak things a little bit and not use NACKs. We'll just acknowledge, but include the sequence number as part of the acknowledgement. And then the sender has an expectation about what it's going to get, and if that's not satisfied, its reaction is retransmit. Okay, so tweak that. The difference is that we send ACK 1 or ACK 0, and we pay attention to which one we received. That's fine. All right. Well, the problem is that real channels are in fact lossy as well as able to corrupt things. So the techniques we've used up to now help, but we need more. And the more is, if you think about it, suppose I send you a letter, and you're expecting this letter, and you don't get it. What do you do? You call me up and say, I didn't get the letter. How long did you wait? before doing that. A reasonable amount of time, right? Something related to how to when you expected the letter, and some additional time for things that might have reasonably gone wrong, and then you picked up the phone and said, "I didn't get it." So that's the idea of a timeout, right? A timeout is some delay that's inserted into the protocol locally at either end. So it's purely relative to when you did something, you wait for something else to happen. And if it hasn't happened, you do something else. So this will use the previous finite set of finite state machines, but we'll just add a timeout timer as another kind of event that can show up in the finite state machines. So how does this one go? When you send something, you start a timer now. When you get the ACK for the thing you just sent, there's a missing arrowhead here. Okay, so we start here, we send a packet, we're waiting for an ACK to come back. If it's a good ACK, if it's the one we're waiting for and it's not corrupt, we'll move into the next state. But as long as we get a corrupt ACK, we won't do anything, and if we get a timeout, we'll resend the packet. Now, some people would say if you get a corrupt packet here or a wrong ACK, you might resend the packet as well. But if you don't, that's okay, because if it comes, you're good, you move, and if it's not coming, you'll do a timeout. So that's all right. And then symmetrically, once we're in this state, we do the same thing to move back there. All right. Yeah, Michael.
And correct me if I'm wrong, this doesn't account for like parallel communications, correct?
That's right. This is an example. That's a good point. I'll say it explicitly. This is an example of what's called a stop and wait protocol, because the sender sends and then stops until it has the acknowledgement before it sends the next thing. Thank you. This is stop and wait. All of these have been stop and wait. So you can look at pretty pictures like this and see what happens. You know, you can trace through what the states are, what the actions are, what the acknowledgments are. You can see what happens with a loss. The timeout happens and you resend the packet you just sent. You should work out similarly what happens if suppose this packet were delivered and the ACK were lost. What would be different? What would be different? So the packet is lost. The packet is delivered. The ACK is lost. From the sender's point of view, the same thing happens, right? But from the receiver's point of view, it's already delivered packet 1. So now when it gets packet 1, which it's going to do again, what does it do? It still has to acknowledge packet 1, even though it doesn't actually deliver it. And hopefully that's shown. That's a delayed example. They didn't actually show the receiver. What?
The receiver doesn't get.
I'm supposing a different situation.
Oh, okay.
Where this is delivered, but it's the ACK that's lost. Okay? No, the next slide has a reordering late packet situation, I think. We'll look in a second. But we can figure it out here anyway. But so from the sender's perspective, the situation where it's the ACK that's lost looks just like the situation where the packet was lost. And so it resends. From the receiver's perspective, packet 1 here has been delivered. But since the sender sends packet 1 again, the receiver needs to remember that it delivered packet 1. It doesn't deliver it again, but it does ACK it again.
Or does it deliver it, when you say deliver it, deliver it to the ACK?
Deliver to the ACK. Okay. Yeah, that's always what I mean by deliver. At least today. Okay, so another thing that can happen is that suppose this ACK takes a long time, longer than expected. That still looks the same to the sender. The timeout occurs. It resends packet 1. Well, that looks the same as the second case that we just talked about on the previous slide. The receiver is going to send ACK 1. But maybe the sender has sent packet 0 by then. It's not waiting for ACK 1. So it says, I have no use for that ACK, and just ignores it. Doesn't have to do anything in that case. I see. You're right. This one is right here. I didn't see didn't look that far across the screen. Okay, so this works, but it's lousy. And it goes back to those calculations that we did at the beginning of the semester about bandwidth delay products and how things work. So, here's an example. We want to figure out how much of this 1 gigabit per second link we're using when running RDT 3.0. And we'll assume a 15 millisecond propagation delay, which corresponds to 15 milliseconds is like going halfway across the continent, say. Yeah.
Is that only having one bit to represent the order of the packets the actual standard for RDT 3, or is that just a kind of a simplified example for RDT 5?
That the one bit is characteristic of the stop and wait protocols. Okay, so RDT 3 is just a name that the authors of this book have given to this protocol.
Oh.
Okay, but
I never actually heard of that.
Right. No, it's a conceptual protocol.
Okay.
When we get to actually doing TCP, it gets much more complicated. So, but. To motivate getting to TCP, let's look at the utilization of this link. So the transmission time is 1,000 bytes over, or 8,000 bits over 10 to the 9th bits per second is 8 microseconds, like it says. So what happens? We send for 8 microseconds, and then we wait 30 milliseconds for the act to come back, and then we send for 8 microseconds and wait 30 milliseconds. Okay, so, like I said, it's lousy. So we're actually sending for, this is worked out in milliseconds, 0.008 milliseconds, and we're waiting for 30.008 milliseconds, and so it's actually busy way, way less than 1% of the time. And so the 1 gigabit per second link is actually only delivering 33 kilobytes per second. Okay, so that's just a big waste of money, shall we say, to hire a link of that speed for that sort of utilization. So we got to fix that. Oh, this is a graphical picture of the same thing. You can see it in the book. See the idea here is that it takes us this is the first bit of the packet being sent. This is the last bit being sent, so that takes up this much time at the sender and that much time sometime later at the receiver. Is it obvious that time progresses downwards in all these pictures? Okay. just make sure. And space is horizontal, so the time here is later at this location in space is later than the time there at that location. All right, and we don't worry about relativistic effects, mostly, until we start going to Mars and beyond. Okay, so you figure out the utilization, and it's terrible. So to overcome this, we need some way to have, we need protocols that support having multiple packets being sent before the acknowledgement for the first one is received. How much do they need to support? How much outstanding data do we have to account for? That is, data that has been sent but we have not received ACTS for on a given link. It's not divided. I think you're on the right track. It's sort of how long does it take to fill up with data that pipe, essentially. And the key number there that we've talked about before is the bandwidth delay product, right? Because in a certain amount of time, in the amount of time that it takes the first bit to go from here to here, you just have to keep sending for that amount of time. So the delay is how long it takes the first bit to go from here to here, and you want to keep sending that whole time, and how much you have to send is the bandwidth. And so you get the bandwidth delay product for that. And actually, it's worse than that because you also have to wait for the ACT to come back. So it's twice the one-way bandwidth delay product that you have to be able to launch into the network before you get your first ACT back. But we usually say the bandwidth delay product and talk about it being the round-trip delay. So that's you got to watch out for that. That's a way to get tripped up. Yeah.
So, well, it's still receiving the ACT as it sends the packet in, but it just has several on the line at the same time.
I don't know what you mean by that.
Well, it still goes send data, receive acknowledgement for that packet in that order.
Right. But you have to keep track of all these packets and match up the acknowledgments to the right. On the sender side, we've got to be able to resend any of these packets because any of them might get lost. So we have to keep track of them, and when we get an ACK back, we say, I've sent that packet, it's okay.
The way I'm understanding this is that it could be like send 1, 2, 3, 4 packets and then receive acknowledgements 1, 2, 3, 4. But if it only gets 1, 2, and 4, then it has to send 3 again, so they're out of order.
Right. So that's what we get. That's what we get into here with two different varieties of these pipeline protocols, the so-called go back in ones and the selective repeat ones. So we're going to talk about those. The difference being that with go back in is simpler. It says when there's a hole in the acknowledgement sequence, I sort of go back and start resending at that point, versus selective repeat that says when there's a hole, I just send the missing data. Okay? And see what happens. So we will talk about those here. All right. So graphically, right, the idea is that you want to fill things up so that you really want to be sort of sending continuously throughout this period with the ACKs coming back, and doing that you can get the utilization up as close as you want to 1 modulo the actual errors that occur. Okay, so the pipelined protocols are go back in and selective repeat. I think we'll just do the high-level description today and see what's next. So go back in. The idea is what is this number n? We said it needs to be the bandwidth delay product, chopped up into packets, but that's how much data we need to get out. The receiver acts sends acknowledgments with numbers in them that reflect the uninterrupted flow of data. So when you get the receiver has received, say that much, meaning that we received all of this and then that one was missing and then we received that, the receiver will just, as it receives these additional packets, will just keep acknowledging that point right there. Okay? And it will, in fact, ignore everything that comes later. It says, I have no use for that. You haven't given me, there's a hole in what I've received, and so you have to give me that packet before I'm willing to go on. The sender keeps track of the oldest unacknowledged packet, and in that case this one was lost, so when the timeout occurs, it just starts over at this point and goes on. Yeah.
You might have mentioned this already. If I missed it, sorry.
That's okay.
How many bits is the ACK usually? I mean, I guess it would depend on your pipelining situation.
It does.
How many you got to keep track of, but in general.
Like, right. So for TCP, it's 32 bits.
Okay.
Yeah. It uses sequence numbers acknowledgement numbers that are 32 bits long. And that's actually not enough.
Really? For an unsigned 32-bit int?
What?
If it's an unsigned 32-bit int?
Yeah, that's actually... It's not enough in environments where the link speeds are getting up to 100 gigabits per second and the distances are even getting up to continental scale. So there are, you know, that's another thing that IP version 6 had to fix, was how to have bigger sequence numbers. They also use, yeah. Okay, so that's go back in. And the selective repeat then says, well, we lost that one, but we get the receiver goes ahead and accepts these. It doesn't deliver them. It has to be able to buffer them, right? Because it's not allowed to deliver things out of order, and it's still missing a whole, this as a whole. But it does buffer them, and it doesn't acknowledge this one. It does acknowledge this one. Eventually, the sender says, oh, this one timed out. I'll resend it, and that will fill in the hole. Let's start back here.
That sounds like the possibility of like a denial of service attack. If you just formulated those and just didn't send packets and fill those above them.
Right. If you can suppress the acknowledgments, you can force the receiver to fill up its buffer. But that's, you know, suppressing the acts is a kind of denial of service already. Right, and I guess the sender can. All right, so another possibility here is suppose that the operating system on this end has a limited amount of space for buffers. It doesn't try to allocate space for all the streams it has open. It tries to share that between streams. A sender, you're right, could attack this by sort of sending it data that had lots of holes in it, or just had a hole in it, and sort of never letting it fill in. Yeah.
Is there a requirement for both the sender and receiver to have similar buffer sizes for timeout and that type of thing? Because if the sender had a smaller one than the receiver, I can see some issues.
So, with this one, the receiver needs no buffer. Right.
For
go back in, the receiver needs no buffer. The sender needs essentially a bandwidth delays products worth of buffer, because that's how many it's willing to have outstanding. With this one, the sender still needs to have that buffer, and so does the receiver, right? Because the receiver here is willing to buffer the packets. Although here the receiver could throw away things if it decided it didn't want them by just not acting them.
Right.
Once it's acted, it really has to keep it. But if it decides it's too much, it can just say.
Well, it wouldn't keep it once it's acted, right? It just deliver it to the
app. No, it can act things that it hasn't delivered, that it can't deliver yet.
Right, because
it's waiting for the hole to be filled in. Right. This is very tricky, and like I said, it took like 20, 25 years to sort of work out all the details in the actual implementation of this stuff as it appears in TCP to get it right.
So if by the time, or if there's a hole, say, and by the time it's filled with the buffer, does it just not accept any more packets at that point?
Right.
It just waits for the hole.
Right.
And then by the time that happens, it should have timed out and done essentially.
Right. Yeah. The receiver can decide to stop receiving at any point. The sender may not be too happy, and it may start sending stuff. But hopefully the timeout for this one occurs well before the timeout for the much later ones. And so when it resends them, they should be okay.
Yeah,